Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled. Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Pixel Sift. Don't Will Smith switch the channel or whatever, because we'll have a swifty show in store for you today. I'm Gianni, and I'm joined today by two Nintendo Switch supporters, Mitch and Scott.
Hey, hey.
What do we have in store today, boys?
Yeah, we'll be looking at the video game voice actors strike that's currently occurring in the US and worldwide.
My name is Gustav Seymour. The studio is called Lost Goblin. It's been around for just over 3 years now. This is our first big game, and the game is Goblins of Elderstone.
We're also having a chat to Gustav Seymour of Lost Goblin, as he very articulately put through there, and we'll be talking about their game Goblins of Elderstone.
Our final topic for today, we'll be having a look at the freshly announced Nintendo Switch.
That's what we've got. We've got more. It's all going to be all over the place. Right now, though, let's jump into our first topic.
Pixel Sift. Pixel Sift. No, seriously, Pixel Sift. No, seriously.
Pixel Sift.
So the Screen Actors Guild of America... Screen Guild American Federation of Television, Radio, Artists, SAG-AFTRA have gone on strike.
Say that 10 times
quickly. Oh, man. I've been practicing and it just...
No wonder it's a acronym. Yeah. That's all I can say.
All right, so you may remember about a year ago we covered this extremely similar situation back in episode 3 of Pixel Sift. SAG-AFTRA believes
it's actually not even an extremely similar situation. It's pretty much the same.
It's still going on.
Basically, they started it back in episode 3, and it's kind of been ongoing until now, and they have actually set a strike date.
We've actually been looking to cover it quite a few times over the year, but it hasn't really gained as much momentum as it has in the past 48 hours or week.
Mm-hmm.
So companies are still failing to compensate their voice talent appropriately, and as of the 21st of October, they have gone on strike.
That's right, and there's some pretty high-profile names in there, names and probably voices, actually, that you would recognize. Some of the big people who have come out about and sort of stressed the reason why for this negotiation and the updates of contract is Jennifer Hale, who you will probably know from the Mass Effect series. She plays the female Shepard character. She also does a bunch of voices in Halo. And also Steve Bloom, who you would definitely recognize from a plethora of different games, Dawn of War 2. You'll know his voice when you hear it. Well, basically, they gave us a few reasons. They didn't give us a few reasons, but they've given a few reasons as to why this is a really important thing. Jennifer Hale was talking to NPR's All Tech Considered, and Steve Bloom was on their website. Let's have a listen to that one there. Actually, no, I haven't got it ready yet, so let's go for something else first.
Yeah, so Jennifer Hale's one of the coolest people ever.
But some of the companies also affected, not just people, Activision Publishing, Disney Character Voices, Electronic Arts Productions, Insomniac Games, Interactive Associates, Take-Two, WB Games, it's across the board. It's going to,
there's definitely some big names and big high-profile companies in there. Let's have a listen to that now.
Yeah. I have friends who have had to have surgery because of the vocal stress they incurred in the session, and they've been out of work for months. We're asking for basic safety parameters around what we call vocal stress.
Now, I've worked on about 400 video games in my career. In fact, I hold the Guinness World Record for working on more games than anyone. The reason I have to work on that many is because there is no secondary compensation in our contract. I've worked on games that have grossed in the billions, yet never received an extra dime on the back end.
Man, that voice.
So familiar. You know him from many, many different things. Steve Bloom there and Jennifer Hale at the top there. Secondary compensation that they're talking about there is basically bonuses and sort of ongoing royalties as part of being in a video game. It sort of does happen in film and TV. You can see some of the high-profile films where an actor, for example, will, if they... You know, a movie is huge in DVD or huge and grosses massively, they get some sort of bonus and extra work as part of that.
So. Even in cases like in TV, like syndication, like Jerry Seinfeld apparently earns like the majority of his money from the syndication of the show.
Well, Jerry Seinfeld's slightly different because he was a producer on the show.
Yeah.
So, but it is sort of in essence the same sort of...
I mean, he is still heavily a performer as well.
Yeah, but you're thinking about this, right? You've got something which is obviously a very... you know, honed skill. It's not something that everyone can do. It's something that does have a lot of stress. And, you know, when your voice is your talent and it is your basically what you make your money off, they're talking about people who have vocal stress and all of that sort of stuff. That means all of your money stops as soon as you're not recording more voice parts. So that's why there's this, sort of this untenable sort of situation where people are not able to, you know, have a sort of a good safety net underneath. So
it's also in terms of they're talking... A lot of them now do their own motion capture, mm-hmm. and that involves stunt work. It is stunt work, and video games is one of the only industries where a stunt coordinator isn't actually mandatory.
Set, hired on set, yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, every other form would have that.
If you've seen some of the making of videos of things like any of the Naughty Dog games, basically the actors themselves who do the voices actually act out everything in a mocap suit. You know, they're there doing everything. Like most of the animations will get tidied up in the end, but the you know, the character building and the, you know, the acting is actually done in person. So, you know, not having someone on set to kind of make sure that everything is safe and that people aren't getting injured or hurt or, you know, they're not going to put strain on themselves and cause...
There's an example of a game trying to do a wire pull without a stunt coordinator and they pulled it off, but the guy got hurt and, yeah, was out of work for a long while, apparently. There's a problem with the industry not taking this... strike kind of or the negotiation seriously. It's going to be going on for like 19 months and it's just like I said, it's like they're not being taken seriously. For instance, like there is a response to concerns about vocal safety. They offered to put more tea and water in the booths for the actors, which they already do, but they, you know, it's just chump offerings.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about, you know, people who have these damage to their throat. A cup of tea and a cup of water is not gonna fix that. If you have been recording screams and yells for, you know, days at a time because you're doing a particularly action intensive scene, that causes damage, and you know that's why people who you know work in these sort of things have to make sure that they
also like another thing that I read, which was pretty ridiculous for someone who's an actor, is them not being told about the roles that they're going to have to play.
That's
right. There's all sorts of kind of moral and ethical obligations. Problems that are kind of come there because, you know, there's, you know, sexual scenes, there's, you know, racial kind of slurs and stuff, you know, although, you know, I guess acting it out is, you know, not actually committing it, but still people are going to have problems with that.
And also there's artistic compromises that you have to make, because the example that was given was the voice actor for the character Kellogg, who is one of the main sort of antagonists in Fallout 4. He didn't know that he was in Fallout 4 until the game came out.
Yeah, see, that's silly. Like, there's no way you would, as any kind of actor in any other kind of, you know, medium, would you not be told what you're supposed to be playing?
Also, it's
and
the
just
amount
dropped
of,
on you, you know,
the amount of time commitment as well. They're not told that either.
And we've heard, like, we've heard their voices; they're amazing. You know, we don't possess that. It's not a normal thing. It's a talent.
It's funny. I saw a lot of conversation online where people were saying that yes, so, you know, a game is, voice actors are important, but they're not more important than other aspects of the game, and they're like, oh, we can put any old person in. But I think the thing is, you don't, it's not really just as simple as that. Sure, some games would be fine without, you know, a high level professional voice actor, but, you know, not every game would be. Say a very story rich game, something like your, you know, your GTAs and all of these other games.
Yeah, there's a reason why they games like that hire high profile voice actors, or even high profile celebrity, like people who just happen to have amazing voices.
Yeah. The other big factor to this as well is that because there is, you know, such a strain and a requirement for a certain number of people, it actually doesn't let anyone else get into the industry as well. So one of the other complaints you often hear people say is that, oh, you know, Steve Bloom does every voice in every game, or, you know, there'd be the repeated people, Jennifer Hale does a lot of voices. And that's the reason why, is because it is very stressful and it is very taxing, and there is an ability for other people to kind of have that nice sort of safety net in order to make this a living and, you know, people to take a bit of a risk and, and try get into the industry.
As you know, like, I love sound. I love the audio side of things always. I think that's the main factor in games' ability to, you know, continue immersion. And vocals and dialogue are just as key players as music and scores.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
They bring these characters to life, and I think something someone needs to speak for them now.
I'd bloody hate to hear my voice on a character on any game. It would just bring me out of it. Or not mine, but like my caliber of voice. Yeah. It's just like, too nasally.
Stick to the music, Scott.
Yeah, that's it.
Stick to that. Well, it's the thing is, we're bringing up the value of games as an artistic measure in society.
Yeah.
And surely then we could be able to bring every aspect of that in there. Well, you know, we talk about them as being able to do these great things and explore great themes. And let's say that the people who create these voices and voice actors in these things are also in the same way artists as they would be in any other industry.
Well said.
Let's jump into our interview with Gustav.
You're listening to Pixel Sip.
This weekend, I spoke to Gustav Seymour. Actually, no, I didn't. I was there.
You did not speak to him.
I was planning to. Mitch did. I was there in spirit. I lost my voice on the weekend, so I wasn't doing any speaking at all. And Mitch spoke to Gustav Seymour. He's from Lost Goblin, which is based in Auckland, New Zealand. We spoke all about his game, Goblins of Elderstone. Are you noticing a little bit of a theme here?
Yep.
And he told us all about it.
It's a goblin tribe simulator. So it's a city builder with a bit of a twist. It's got light RPG and sort of 4X grand strategy elements. And yeah, you are the goblin king or queen of a tribe. You create a new tribe every time you play. You randomize your world. You pick an environment to start playing on, and then you build a village. You grow your tribe, initially only with one clan and eventually multiple clans. You try and survive against the odds of the world and the NPCs in the world map. As the tribe grows, as the clans grow, you will need more resources. Then you can raid other locations in the world map. You can trade with NPCs, and you will also engage in text-based RPG story moments that are randomized. And eventually, you will also be dealing with the gods that you pick at the creation point in the game when you start.
You mentioned a 4X, was that a combat system? What does that actually mean?
Well, 4X grand strategy. So it's 4X games are, I think the X's are expansion, exploration, extermination, and...
don't worry about it. We'll
yeah. So it's a genre of gameplay. So in ours, the exploration is the world map. You scout the tiles around you to explore the map to find the other NPCs. Exploitation is the resources. You exploit the resources. Extermination is, well, if you basically conquer everyone else and. Expand is the other one. You expand your influence on the region map. So it's got elements of all of that on the strategy layer of the game, but its core gameplay is a city builder, a survivalist city builder.
Awesome. So are the maps procedurally generated?
Yes. So every time you play, you can choose the size of the map that you want to play, which will obviously determine the length of your game and the difficulty. And there'll be future settings that we'll add as well to customize your gameplay. And then on the region map, there'll be a number of NPCs based on the size of the map. And those world maps are made out of different tiles that are made out of different environment types, like mountain, grassland, swamp, forest, whatever. And yeah, so those are randomized every time you play. And you can randomize it. There's a button to randomize.
Does that make designing the game mechanics difficult?
It makes it different. The balancing comes within the systems. So if you plan ahead that it will be a procedural game, then you create your systems to accommodate that. So you still have to balance all the systems, obviously. And you need to test for big outliers. If somebody rolls a map that only has good or only has bad things, it still needs to be playable. But yeah, it's a different challenge.
So how did your team form?
So most of us, well, all of us have worked together at studios before. When we founded, we three of the core team were working at Gameloft in Auckland and were leads on projects and worked really well together and decided at the time that we wanted bigger things and we wanted to make our own games and have our own studio. So that's how we formed. And subsequently, all the other members, we've worked together at different studios since.
What are the best aspects of City Builders and what are you aiming to improve on?
One of the reasons we wanted to make this game was at the time we were playing Banished. We're big fans of City Builder games. I play almost every one that comes out. And we felt what was lacking in the City Builder games that when we were discussing was an end game. You usually get to a state in these City Builder games where you've kind of figured out all the systems, you've gotten good at setting up your city, and then it would kind of get a bit boring because there wasn't anything else happening. There were no threats big enough to throw the system into chaos. And that's why we chose goblins as our race, because inherently they're chaotic, and we felt like this was a good way to inject what we call chaos systems into the design, where things could be going really well, and then because a goblin is upset because you haven't looked after a certain element in the game, they might start stealing from another clan or burn down a building and then throw your system into a little bit of chaos, and then you have to deal with that. So yeah, it's most City Builder games have some element of that, but that's something that we wanted to kind of focus on and strengthen.
What's the game development scene like in Auckland and New Zealand?
It's growing a lot. I moved to Auckland 5 years ago, and when Gameloft opened here, and Gameloft has since come and gone, and many indie studios and other studios have popped up since. So it's a pretty big community now. The game developers meetup in Auckland is where we launched the Kickstarter campaign, and the launch went really well. There were lots, some of the meetups have a few hundred people. And we recently had the New Zealand Game Developers Conference, which was quite large. I don't remember the exact number now, but I think it's 2,000 game developers in New Zealand, and most, I'd say half are in Auckland. So it's quite big. It's definitely grown, and it's very healthy.
Awesome. So what would you like to see change to help the New Zealand scene grow?
The biggest problem we have is what I think most indies anywhere have is funding. Melbourne, for example, in Australia has a really good funding model. They had, and now again, we've got a good community, we've got all the skills, we've got excellent students coming through some of the tertiary institutes, relatively easy to hire skilled people from overseas. The one thing we don't have is funding. Funding is extremely difficult. We're hoping, the NZGDC is working really hard with the government to try and change that. The films industry obviously gets a lot of funding, but hopefully games can eventually get some of that funding as well.
All right, let's talk about your Kickstarter now. So was the game going to happen with or without the Kickstarter? Was it necessary? Was it vital?
Yeah, so we've been working on the game about 18 months. Now, 6 months was prototyping and design and early stage. And then we had funding from a company, so invested into the game once we got past the prototyping stage. And that allowed us to work full time for about 10 months, a little bit less, 9 months. We worked full time. That got us to this stage so that we could launch the Kickstarter. I think we feel like it's at a stage where we can show people and have a Kickstarter so that we can deliver an alpha afterwards for people to play the game. If the Kickstarter, it looks like it's going to be successful. We're 86% or something now. But if it wasn't, and if we weren't going to do it, I think it would have taken a very long time for us to actually finish the game in a high quality kind of way. So the objective is for us to go back to working full time on the game, and hence the necessity for the Kickstarter.
Looking back at the creative process, The art style is very colorful. Goblins are often portrayed as like dark or scary or like really almost cannon fodder in almost every other video game in existence. What made you move away from this?
Well, that's what you said is actually one of the reasons. I love goblins. I used to when I still do build Magic the Gathering decks of goblin flunkies and goblin decks. I play goblins in Warhammer. I'm a big fan of them, like in all their different styles and variations. I just think they're, you know, they can be quite cute in their chaotic nature. And yes, they're always cannon fodder. They get mercilessly slaughtered by everyone. So we thought it would be kind of fun to have a village builder or a game where they were the protagonists and they're the heroes. And you're just building your village. You're just minding your own business, and heroes show up and try and murder everyone. And the heroes come off as the bad guys. If an adventuring party arrives on your map and tries to slaughter all your villagers, you might have more sympathy for goblins the next time you play D&D or something.
Thank you very much for your time, Gustav.
Thanks so much, Mitchell. Really appreciate it.
Gustav Seymour of Lost Goblin. They're based in Auckland. You can find Goblins of Elderstone on Kickstarter right now. If you go onto the internet, you'll be able to find them. You can back them. If you're heading to PAX Oz next weekend, as we are, you can go and check them out there as well. They're one of the selected games for the Australian Indie Showcase.
They will be at Stand 35 exactly if you are in the idea of getting
sit there with your map and getting your map ready.
But also on top of Kickstarter, if you want to find them online, Steam Greenlight as well. They're at Lost Goblin on Twitter. They've got Facebook. They've got their own website. They're on Unreal forums. They've got their own subreddit. Basically, they're just all over Google. Google it.
Exactly right. Let's jump into the next one.
Pixel Sieve.
It's not Pixel Sieve. It's Pixel Sift.
Pixel Sieve.
So by now you've most likely seen the awesome video of Nintendo's new flagship device, the Nintendo Switch. While there's still a heap we don't know about it, there is also a bunch we do. We're all a little excited, as we've noticed many others are, and as such, our final topic for today, episode 53, will be opening up on all the details we know so far. First off, initial thoughts, people?
Okay, so can you connect two of like them together?
Oh, we don't. Well,
as in like two of the screens together? Because I assume one side's male and one side's female, right?
What?
I mean, like, no, I mean, like, as in the connector pins on either side.
They can't. From what I understand, you're talking about the mobile bit.
Yeah, I'm
there's
talking
not
going to
be no connections whatsoever.
Oh. Wait. So I understand. Okay. These little things on the side, which are called Joy-Cons, and you're saying take off the Joy-Cons and jam them two of them together.
Because the Joy-Cons can connect together themselves, right?
They connect into another little...
They've got a grid. Oh, okay. I completely misinterpreted this whole product. Because I thought they were kind of like a railing system.
It's an interesting insight into the way that Mitch's mind
works. Let me give you a rundown, Mitch. Yeah. So you've got the dock, which is basically how it will connect to video, like how to connect to TV and stuff. Then you've got your Joy-Con controllers, which in the middle of that is your Joy-Con grip.
Yep.
So you can take your... And it's a little bit under... It's a bit not understood what exactly will come in the base kind of kit. Mm-hmm. But the dock...
It's ambiguous.
Yeah. At the moment, we're not sure. I mean, like I said, all of this is a little bit unsure. We're definitely not going to go into any specs or anything, because that is just up in the air. Rumor details.
It'll have 10,000 teraflops.
10,000 graphics.
10,000 points. So it's going to be out sometime in March next year.
Yep.
It's still a bit loose. They're not going to confirm the price until January at the earliest.
It's really interesting because I feel like, and tell me if this is your experience, it seemed like we were waiting a very long time for the Nintendo NX. And I think a lot of people were very keen to get away from the Wii U. They said, shelve it, put it away. We don't want to know about it anymore. It just didn't have the commercial success of the Wii. Everyone kind of that I know of basically went out and got one with a Wii, but no one I knew, like I know one person who owns a Wii U, and they run a Nintendo podcast. So, you know, that's basically about it. So it seems like it was no noise. And then all of a sudden we got all of this information and we're waiting until next Christmas. It's coming out in March. So it seems like no news was good news because they finished the console, basically.
Well, there's a few things we know. There's a few things that are very likely anyway. There's likely it's going to be touch. And if it is touch, it's also likely that it's going to have a stylus, much like the last slew of Nintendo devices, I guess. Mm-hmm. Backwards compatibility.
I don't know about that. I don't know about the stylus.
Yeah, neither do I.
I wonder if it will.
It's just because
would it be like a special Nintendo stylus, or will it just be like something that you can just?
It could be the same as the one for the Wii.
See, a lot of people speaking about the touch. I think there is an interesting thing that they've done with that. Is they haven't emphasized the touch features in the console. The Wii U gamepad had touch built into it. I think it was it's all multi-touchy sort of stuff. But they haven't emphasized this because if you look at the actual console itself, it does actually look like almost like an Android tablet style sort of tablet. And I think what they were trying to do is differentiate themselves from being another tablet to consumers out there versus an actual console, which is something different.
But looking at it, it seems like thicker than this laptop almost when it's closed. So like, how is that going to feel? Like, how is that going to be like an iPad territory? Because that's just
It's just a tablet. Like, it's just a regular kind of size, small, like an iPad mini or something like that.
Hmm. It seemed a lot bigger than that, though.
I didn't kind of look at it too much, but it didn't seem like it was going to be that thick. I could be wrong, because you are right. Like, it could be thick enough because it's got controllers on the side, and it needs to have the attachments for that. So it's got to be not too thin, otherwise it's going to be flimsy and cheap. We'll see.
Another really interesting thing about this, especially in the way that we've seen this promotional trailer that's come out, is the way that they've positioned the console. You can look at the type of people who are actually in the basically in the clip, and they are mostly sort of like 20-somethings who don't look like gaming is their main thing. They're just kind of doing gaming as an aside. Maybe they're waiting for a plane. Maybe they're playing some basketball and they're like, let's play as our favorite basketball team here. Or maybe we are having a rooftop party and we're going to come bring my console over to...
Damn it.
Karen has got a
damn
name.
Damn it, Karen.
Yeah, Karen always bringing a Nintendo thing to the
There's
party.
Some great
we actually
meme.
Just want to have... Yeah, get on...
There's some good memes flying around.
Get good memeing.
So my one concern here, and this is a pro and or con, and why I've got so many people excited about it, that, yeah, generally aren't really into gaming as much as, say, the rest of us. But, they probably were back in the Nintendo days and whatever, and this is kind of going to bring them back. It's like, it's a combination of everything that Nintendo does well, I feel. The handhold stuff, the accessibility of the games and whatever. Only problem I have here is it could kill their current handheld market, throwing all their eggs in one basket.
I think the handheld's gone. Yeah. To be honest, I think it's going to start, unless there's something really significantly different, but I think this is basically the end of it and this is going to be a hybrid console. But on your point of saying that I think it's going to be really good for people who maybe played in the SNES or the 64 era, who have fond memories of Mario Kart, all we need to do is look at Pokemon Go. Because that was huge, and that really did that exact thing that I think Nintendo is positioning this for, in that they're aiming for a market of people who have a nostalgia for gaming, who probably have busy lives, are doing other bits and pieces, who want to jump in, play a fun game at something that is kind of, cool and fun. And it's not gaming per se. It's kind of just like, we're going to play some Mario Kart.
Well, I did have a small chat to someone on instant message about the Switch, and I said, hey, are you excited? And he mentioned if there aren't X title and X title, both of which are classic Nintendo titles, he's not interested. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because he's a very dedicated Nintendo fan, and he's a very big gamer, but Nintendo is pretty much where he's at, and he loves it. But if that level of fan is not going to expect or want innovation for Nintendo, how can Nintendo really I guess, service anyone at that point.
Look, if one thing that Nintendo does, it's that they definitely bring their major franchises across to every console in different iterations. So I think
your
friend
any worry about that.
No worries.
I mean, like, I already know that.
Unless they're asking for something like Kid Icarus, which maybe, I don't know, will get a rerun on the new console. But yeah, your Metroids are going to be there.
I'm just concerned about the company as a whole if they don't, like, I think the only new IP that I can remember of recent times is Splatoon.
Yeah. Well, and they made a big...
And please correct me if I'm wrong in the chat, because I'm not heavy on Nintendo knowledge.
Yeah, and I think that is one of the big ones, and they made a big emphasis on that in the actual thing, positioning it as an esports device as well.
Yeah, really liked Splatoon.
Mm. We've basically run out of time, but one more thing just before we say is I am very excited for the possibility of a console home version of Pokemon, something they haven't talked about for a long time.
Yep. Maybe they'll just disable the dock. It seems a little outside the philosophy of Pokemon in general, though, because I think...
Yeah, maybe you're not going to be able to plug it back in. They're just like, no.
Yeah,
play it with your friends in the park.
Well, anyway, we're going to have to wait until January 12th, I believe, for this Nintendo Switch presentation, and that'll be where all the media get invited for the proper unveil.
That's right.
Are we going to get invited?
Probably not, but...
Johnny, get us an invite.
Might be able to put our press strings in.
We'll see how we go. They're going to be over at PAX. So
get some flights comped.
Yeah.
You know. That's all we got time for today, guys. Thank you very much for joining us for an episode of Pixel Sift. We're not having one next week because we are going to be over at PAX Australia in Melbourne, and we'll have heaps of other bits and pieces, though. So keep an eye on our social media because we're going to be putting videos and
lots
interviews
of little packages and stuff.
All of that sort of stuff, and in the coming months. And
I might tweet once or twice.
Mitch might even tweet. We'll have heaps of stuff there, so get on that. Scott.
Yes, you can find us
at Facebook. Scott and looked at me. What's up with that,
I'm
dude?
Throwing it around. Mm-hmm. Mixing
it
up.
Find us at
First
Facebook.
First, you thought you interviewed.
Come on. Let me do the social medias. How else are people going to find us?
Yeah.
Facebook.com/PixelSift, Twitter.com/PixelSift, Twitch.tv/PixelSift, and YouTube.com/PixelSiftAU.
And people aren't going to be looking at our new episodes because they're going to be getting excited about all the new stuff coming out of PAX, Mitch. But once they've finished all that, they're going to go back to our old episodes, aren't they? And where are they going to find them?
So you can find the old episodes on our website. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Pocket Casts, and pretty much every other good iTunes
podcast platform. That's right.
But where will most of our PAX content be, Johnny?
It'll be on social media, Facebook and Twitter. That's where most of
YouTube?
It will be.
Yep.
A little bit of YouTube as well.
Nice.
So there we go. All right, thanks, guys. We will see you maybe in Melbourne if you're there.
Hope so. Come say hi.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. At sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.